Take a deep breath, look back on the past 12 months, and think about all that's changed in the Korean Peninsula. We went from threats of war to three inter-Korean summits and a prospective second meeting between President Trump and Kim Jong-un. It has been a whirlwind for American audiences thousands of miles away. But how did this all look from the ground in South Korea? Unlike us, South Koreans have been staring down the barrel of North Korean guns for decades. They've also seen their president sue for peace before. So, what has the past year really looked like from the front line? Our guest today will tell us just that. From the Korea Economic Institute in Washington, D.C., I'm your host, Yong Kwon, and this is Korean Context. Jonathan Chang is the Seoul bureau chief for the Wall Street Journal, overseeing the journal's coverage of the Korean Peninsula, including North Korean politics, South Korean politics, and South Korean conglomerates like Samsung, Hyundai, and LG. A veteran journalist, he has traveled to Pyongyang, and he is also credited with bringing international spotlight on the South Korean women's curling team during the Pyeongchang Winter Olympics. Jonathan, welcome back to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
You were on the podcast February, and I feel like we're living in almost a completely different world. Starting with North Korea's participation in the Winter Olympics in South Korea and going through the dramatic meetings between President Moon and Kim Jong-un and then Kim and Trump. So perhaps we can start with, what is the mood like on the ground in Seoul and in South Korea?
Sure. Well, we're now approaching the end of 2018, and you're right. In February, it was a different environment. It was a different mood, although, of course, the seeds of the detente were planted already by then. We had the North Korean athletes and cheerleaders and members of Kim Jong-un's family coming down to South Korea. But I think at that point, there was a lot of uncertainty about how real this all was, about whether or not this was just a publicity stunt by the North Koreans. I suppose you still have some people who think this entire year has been a big publicity stunt, but it certainly feels more real now just because just beyond the Olympics, we've seen all those things that you talked about, the summit meetings, some of which we've never seen before, like a U.S. president meeting with a North Korean leader. We see now an inter-Korean liaison office opened in Kaesong. We have now gotten to the point where there are lots of these sports exchanges happening at the Asian Games in Indonesia, and they don't even go remarked upon anymore because we're so used to seeing the two Koreas march in under the unified Korean flag. It's almost like these have become routine really quickly, and it's only 10 months into this process. So presuming that we still have more room to go, then maybe we are going to see reopening of some of these shuttered inter-Korean cooperation projects like the Kaesong Industrial Complex, like Kumgangsan, the mountain resort, and perhaps even more. We know that Moon Jae-in has a pretty ambitious agenda and program for what he'd like to see happen. And, you know, you got to think that at this point, he's pretty happy with how that has gone, although the other question is denuclearization and the U.S. angle on this. And that is certainly going to be another factor here.
With Moon Jae-in, do you feel like his ambitious program with engaging with North Korea is well-received with the South Korean public? I mean, we've seen his popularity rating soar in the months ahead of the summit in Singapore. But since it's flagged a little bit, is this a reflection of the South Korean public's disenchantment with inter-Korean engagement?
Well, I mean, the conventional wisdom, and I have no reason to really question this, is that any flagging that we've seen in his popularity is primarily because of domestic economic issues, like jobs for the young. You know, the young people really came out to support Moon Jae-in, and many of them are now still looking for work. So you have that sort of thing happening. You have a fight over the minimum wage, over the length of the work week and how many hours can be required of employees, and all these other sort of debates that have come up. That's not to say that there isn't also frustration with how the inter-Korean process is going. You obviously have a pretty hardcore base of conservatives in South Korea who haven't liked this detente process from the very beginning. They've been suspicious of Kim Jong-un from day one, and nothing that they've seen in the past 10 months has changed their minds on this. You have a lot of people in the middle there who perhaps were skeptical of Kim Jong-un, but were willing to give Moon Jae-in a chance given what we saw in 2017 with the threats and with the missile launches and the nuclear test and the rhetoric between Kim Jong-un and Donald Trump, and they were just happy to give Moon Jae-in a chance here to try and do something and break through and then resolve the situation, even if they weren't necessarily trusting of Kim Jong-un. So, I mean, there's a lot of factors going on at the same time. I think we can definitely say that the inter-Korean process has generally been positive. We saw the approval rating for Moon Jae-in fall below 50% earlier this summer, but then after the inter-Korean summit in Pyongyang, it came right back up again. So again, there's got to be continued signs of momentum here. And as I said, the novelty of some of these inter-Korean efforts does wear off. You see it with all that excitement around the two Koreas walking in together at the Olympic opening ceremony to where we are now, where you have all sorts of these sports events where the Koreans are competing together and it gets almost no attention. And yes, the Olympics are bigger than the Asian Games, but even so, it's almost like people aren't even noticing anymore.
Perhaps we can move back to the what you said earlier about the pageantry and the opposition from the conservatives. If I may take the devil's advocate view, I mean, it's not totally without reason, right? The criticism that this has been a lot of form without substance has some credence. I mean, after all, there has been summits in Pyongyang before. Kim Dae-jung and Roh Moo-hyun has gone to Pyongyang before. Joint Korea's team have played in the Olympics before. Right. The unified Korean flag was unfurled in previous Olympics. And the two Koreas have also made declarations before about making peace. And I feel like this has driven a very polar opposite reaction. What do you think is eliciting such a strong reaction currently? This optimism and then a lot of pessimism.
Right.
And I think that's also present in the United States as well. A lot of observers being very pessimistic towards President Trump's approach and then people who are outwardly supportive of the Pyongyang engagement.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think you've captured the pessimism pretty well. People remember the previous engagement efforts. They weren't that long ago, and the images, of course, are still with us. You know, there is a lot of reason to sort of say, well, look, every action that the North Koreans have, you know, you can cast aspersions on them. You look at the destruction of Punggye-ri back in, I believe it was May, when they destroyed their underground nuclear test site. They had indicated, at least the South Koreans had said that the North Koreans had indicated they were willing to allow international inspectors to come in and watch that happen. They didn't do that. They had some TV crews come in from around the world to film it from afar. And when you see something like that, especially when you think back to 2008 when they blew up the cooling tower at Yongbyon, you get a sense of deja vu here. And we know that after 2008, the North Korean nuclear issue wasn't resolved then. And I think there are people who say, well, look, it's the same script that Kim is following. So the pessimism I get. The optimism that you often hear, and you hear this from both the U.S. and from the South Korean side, is the leaders are different. That's going to be the case in South Korea and the U.S. because enough years have passed that in the democratic system, you're going to have new leaders. But of course, you have quite dramatically different leaders in the White House. And of course, you do have a new leader in North Korea. And that isn't necessarily a given, given that they can't serve for quite a long time. And Kim Jong-un is relatively untested in this realm. He hasn't engaged in this sort of high-wire diplomacy yet. His father did a little bit of it. Kim Jong-un, of course, is more public than his father was. We've heard his voice many times. We didn't hear Kim Jong-il's voice very much. He is bringing his wife out on the global stage as well. I mean, all the things that people have pointed to, they're definitely, there's a different cast of characters right now. And that's important because it is so personality driven. And then I think the other thing is, I would say that we had the 2000 summit. We have the 2007 inter-Korean summit, both of those in Pyongyang. But the pace of the summitry this year is truly remarkable. I mean, you've now had three inter-Korean meetings between Moon Jae-in and Kim Jong-un. You've had one and probably another U.S.-North Korea summit, which, of course, are unprecedented. And then you even have Kim Jong-un finding time to squeeze in three trips to China in that time to meet with Xi Jinping. And it's interesting. I think back to when Moon Jae-in was campaigning for president. This is, you know, early last year after Park Geun-hye was impeached. His advisors and his people around him were sort of saying, look, the problem in both the 2000 and the 2007 cases were that Kim Dae-jung, Roh Moo-hyun, they actually ran out of time on their inter-Korean diplomatic efforts. What we want to do if we're elected, what Moon Jae-in wants to do is he wants to start this process right from the beginning of, because as we know in South Korea, you have a single five-year term. It doesn't give you a lot of wiggle room. You don't get to be reelected. So he wants to start this process as early as he can. so that he has enough runway to actually bring things to fruition. So I would definitely say that is something that is unprecedented. And actually, for the first 8 months or so of Moon Jae-in's term, that idea that he would start the inter-Korean process early in his term looked like a total pie-in-the-sky sort of proposition here, because here you had Trump and Kim exchanging threats and missiles and all the rest of it, and you had Moon Jae-in trying to get in the middle and trying to say, let's talk, but it looked like both sides were ignoring him. It looked like it was going nowhere. And of course, this year, it's changed completely.
You definitely captured the importance of the leadership here. There was a National Assembly delegation from South Korea that just went through Washington, D.C., and one of their key objectives was to reassure the American public and bring them more in line with the South Korean view. But that visit itself suggests that between these two allies, there is a fairly divergent public opinion regarding the process right now. In your view, what is the biggest difference in the outlook between the Korean public and the American public? And what do you feel like should be better understood by the American public when talking about the inter-Korean engagement?
Yeah, well, I mean, it won't be totally a revelation, but I think the nuclear issue is essentially the difference here. South Korea, of course, has been under the prospect of military threat for a long time. It didn't require ICBMs to feel nuclear threatened. Really what we saw happen last year is that with the ICBMs that North Korea launched, three of them, that they're now putting the continental U.S. in range potentially with a nuclear device. There are questions about the reentry vehicle and questions about all sorts of technical miniaturization and all the rest of it. But let's just say they're in the ballpark now. They're in the game, the North Koreans. And so that does change things a little bit here for both the Americans and the South Koreans. So obviously, in the U.S., there is a range of views. There's a range of views in South Korea as well, so it'd be hard for me to flatten all of those views into one perspective. But for the sake of argument here, I'll try that, and I'll say that the U.S., I think, is skeptical here. Many people in the foreign policy establishment in Washington appear to be skeptical that North Korea is willing to give up its nuclear program, and that that is a problem for the U.S. and for this entire diplomatic process, because if you don't think that this is going to lead anywhere, then all of these inter-Korean economic and cultural and all the rest of it, insofar as it leads to money getting to Pyongyang and into the hands of Kim Jong-un, then it's too fast. It's moving without the proper prudence and demands that we ought to be making on the nuclear front. And so, again, it comes down to all those things that we've seen with Punggye-ri, with the satellite launch site at Dongchang-ri. What do we do about that? I mean, is that real, or is that something that's just cosmetic? And those are questions that still aren't answered. What about the continued manufacturing and production of missiles and of fissile material? There's no indication that those activities have stopped. So what is all of this, you know, hullabaloo about? Why are we opening inter-Korean liaison offices? Why are we sending sports delegations and K-pop delegations and all the rest of it when we don't have any real meaningful progress? So, I mean, I think that's the real difference. But, you know, to answer that last question of yours, I mean, from the American point of view, I think what may be missed is that for South Korea, nothing had fundamentally changed for South Korea in the very narrow sense of a security or military threat, because that had always existed. Nothing changed in 2017. Now, of course, one could argue, and I think quite convincingly, that because the U.S. is now in range, it changes the strategic calculus for everyone involved, and therefore that does change things for South Korean security. But I would say that, yes, there's definitely a gap, and we've definitely seen strains on the U.S.-South Korea alliance in the past year. For the most part, they've managed to weather them well, especially around the Singapore summit earlier this year. I think there really was a sense that the gap had really narrowed. But then as the strains emerged again in the summer and the fall, I think now you're starting to see them emerge a little bit again. But we'll see where that goes.
In your view, having traveled to North Korea, having watched this whole process from the beginning, from when there was the spate of verbal abuse between Kim Jong-un and President Trump and through the detente, do you see signs of genuineness? And if you do, what are those indicators? What are the indicators that you're looking for when judging the genuineness of the North Korean leadership?
That's a tough question, because we're ultimately asking what is in Kim Jong-un's head, what's in his heart, what's, you know, and in the the heads and the hearts of those around him? And that's a really, really tricky question. Of course, we can point to external things, but external things don't necessarily reveal the internality of things unless they continue to the point where there's no question anymore. And what I'm suggesting in that answer is that time is sometimes what's needed here. And perhaps that's part of the South Korean strategy here, is just we need to keep the momentum going, because the longer the momentum goes, the more we have time to build trust. There's mistrust on both sides, and the U.S. has had a lot of questions about whether North Korea has ever been sincere and genuine in any of the past processes, going back to the agreed framework of 1994 and beyond, whether or not they have been stalling for time this entire time, or whether there was some genuine willingness, but because they didn't feel like it was being reciprocated from the U.S. side and so on, that's why things fell apart. I mean, that's essentially the debate boiled down in one sentence. You're right. It's over sincerity. And I mentioned this earlier. There's plenty of fuel and fodder for those who are skeptical to say, if they had really changed their minds and made a strategic decision to abandon their nuclear weapons, why would they have done Punggye-ri in the way that they did? Why wouldn't they have, if they really were done with that site, if they were really done with nuclear tests, why not invite in international inspectors? The sort of controlled transparency, I think, is something that people who are skeptical point to and say, well, that doesn't look like sincerity to me. Now, you could rebut that and say, look, North Korea has always been a very controlled place in many ways, and they're not going to just suddenly throw the doors wide open. This is how it's got to happen, and we need to build trust, and trust is going to be advanced bit by bit. And from each side, it's got to be reciprocated before we get there. I think I'm punting on your question, basically, because I don't know what the answer is. Right. And I think that is the fundamental fault line between the hawks and the doves, the skeptics and the optimists on this issue.
President Moon Jae-in seems to be adopting your recommendation that we need more time, that time will tell. Time is what's going to build the confidence. And part of what he has seemed to be engaged in is just having more meetings to extend that time. And of course, things are moving so quickly right now that by the time this podcast gets out, events may have moved on. But of course, we're looking forward to the second U.S. DPRK summit between Kim Jong-un and President Trump, and also with the announced visit of Kim Jong-un to Seoul, which would be quite historic. I mean, we've seen South Korean leaders go to North Korea all the time, but the North Korean leader coming to Seoul would be unprecedented. How is South Korea, and maybe more specifically journalists, preparing for the summit in Seoul? When President Moon Jae-in went to Pyongyang, as North Korea's totalitarian state, you can mobilize people to come out and have this massive parade of overwhelming optimism. But South Korea is a very different society, and there's been a lot of worried voices about what the reaction might be if Kim Jong-un goes by a conservative protest or, human rights groups protesting on the streets. Is this something on your mind as a journalist, and what are some things that is kind of going through your mind right now as you prepare for Kim Jong-un's visit to Seoul?
Yeah, that's a good question, and it is, again, highlighting that fundamental distinction between the two Koreas, is that Moon will want to be a good host to Kim Jong-un. He will want it to go smoothly, naturally. Any head of state would want a visiting head of state's visit to go well. On the other hand, you have a lot of people who are on the right and who are pretty suspect and suspicious of what Moon Jae-in has done in terms of conservative voices. You've had people complaining about whether or not they're allowed to fully express their views and their skepticism about this process. I think one instructive test case is simply to look back to the Olympics again, when we had Kim Jong-un's sister, Kim Yo-jong, come down to South Korea, as well as other senior officials. And there were protests. There were protests in Pyeongchang and in Gangneung and in Seoul. There were people who didn't like the fact that the Kim family was coming down south, and that the propaganda orchestra would be performing as well. And there were protests. But actually, I think in the end, I don't think it quite turned out to be the spectacle that we thought it would be in terms of a showdown between protesters and the police or anything like that. Now, that said, Kim Yo-jong is not Kim Jong-un. Kim Jong-un is the supreme leader, and he is You know, he's a really polarizing figure, and I think that's going to be a challenge for the Boone administration to figure out how to handle that. I presume that they will do it in a similar way, which is protests will be allowed, but they're not going to get too close, and they're going to capture a lot of attention, these protests. They will be photographed, and there'll be, you know, images of them will be seen all around the world alongside the images of Moon and Kim shaking hands in Seoul. Actually, I'm personally interested to see how much Moon Jae-in tries to impress the North Korean leader with the prosperity of Seoul. Keep in mind, we had Kim Jong-un walking through Marina Bay Sands in Singapore, so it's not like he's not been shown the splendors of capitalist prosperity before. But it is, again, different in the Korea context. And I really do wonder what will happen then. But of course, as of right now, as we're recording this, we don't have any details on when it's going to be. We just know that it's likely to happen before the end of the year. But we are running out of days here.
With the Trump presidency, there is a sense that it's the news cycle that is driving the events and not the other way around. What do you think the role of the coverage of the Koreas, yourself and others, has had on the way the United States has approached North Korea and engagement with Pyongyang?
Ooh, that's a very meta question. You know, ultimately, I sit in Seoul. I mean, I'm here in Washington now, but I sit in Seoul, and I don't always have a good sense of how people on the other side of the world are perceiving what we're writing. But obviously, I would say that foreign policy establishment here in Washington has largely been skeptical about Kim's motives in this whole process, and their voices do get a lot of weight because these are the people who are going to be speaking to audiences like ours. And it's different in that, unlike other presidents, Donald Trump doesn't engage with the press in the same way that Obama or the Bushes or Clinton did in the past. We don't know exactly how much he does read the press. We know that he watches a lot of TV. We know that he obviously has taken a more adversarial approach towards many of the members of the press. And I think skepticism that's expressed in the press towards this process in particular, the decision to meet with Kim Jong-un in the first place, the decision to scrap the military exercises earlier this year, all of these things, we've seen the president rail against media skepticism of what's going on. But it's interesting in that he was also able to allow himself not to be dragged into certain things, like when, after the Singapore summit, we saw a lot of satellite imagery come out that showed North Korea continuing to expand Yongbyon or some of its missile facilities out by Hamhung or close to Pyongyang and some of these other places. There wasn't any real response from the president or from the government in general. And so even though the media was pointing this out, you know, I wrote some of these articles, but it almost doesn't matter who wrote them because the satellite imagery was out there. And, you know, it wasn't to say that the North Koreans were breaking faith. I mean, there was nothing about these facilities or nothing to stop them from continuing to do what they were doing there. But when this was pointed out, it certainly didn't draw that sort of angry, you know, fake news sort of rhetoric from the president. So it's interesting. I mean, sometimes it looks like the tone of the press can have an impact, but it also looks like at other times it can be ignored if it needs to be to keep the process going. So I don't know. I mean, I don't want to say that the press is uniformly skeptical. That's definitely not true. And I do believe that there are genuine and legitimate reasons for optimism this time around that simply don't exist in the past, that haven't existed in previous rounds of talks between the U.S. and North Korea. It's a different environment now. We have a very unique president occupying the White House. And it's complex. And I'm not totally even sure how it all plays together in one big mix. So again, I think I'm punting on this question as well. But I'm sure that everyone has some view on this. And in any case, I've always seen my role and our role in the press as being one of trying as much as possible to stay out of advocating one view or the other. We're human beings. We will reflect the views of the people that we quote, and we will reflect, you know, whatever views we may have on our own. But as much as possible, we try to stay out of it, and we try to let the reporting speak for itself. But that's not always the case, and it's especially not easy to do when you do have people criticizing you, and not just the president, but also random people on Twitter or whatever else. You know, it's definitely different from 2007, the previous round of inter-Korean symmetry, and it's certainly different from 1994.
And that's it for today's program. Many thanks to Jonathan Chang for coming on the show, and to you for listening to Korean Context. You will find Jonathan's pieces on the Wall Street Journal, wherever newspapers are available, and his Twitter handle is JCHENGWSJ. If you have any questions or comments, send us a tweet at KOREAECONINST. If you haven't already, don't forget to subscribe and rate us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcast. And do check out our Facebook page and tune in for both our events and our Facebook Live program, This Week in Korea, for an overview of developments in Korea every Monday at 2 p.m. See you there.
Thanks for having me, and I'm sorry I didn't get any curling references in there.
Next time.